Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, April 27th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And joining us later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. We'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Jim Kinsella at the Enterprise newspapers. Now we'll look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Island. Cindy, the killing of Yarmouth police officer Sean Gannon continues to reverberate through the region. This week, Cape and Islands legislators asked for an investigation into why the suspect, who had a lengthy record of criminal charges, was not behind bars.
Yeah, it is a question on everyone's mind. And the region's eight state senators and representatives are pushing for an oversight hearing on Beacon Hill. They want to say that they said we need to identify if there are any lapses in the state criminal justice system that allowed Thomas Lantanowicz to avoid prison time at the time of the shooting, the April 12th shooting.
And that's the suspect, Thomas Lantanowicz,
right. Yes. And they sent a letter. The entire delegation. This is not political. Everybody came together on both sides, and they sent a letter to leaders of the state's Joint Committee on the Judiciary and the Joint Committee on Public Safety and Homeland Security, asking for this hearing. And they're concerned about, they said, a combination of not guilty finding by judges, failure of key witnesses to testify, and outright dismissal of charges, because some of the charges against the suspect in the past had involved alleged violence, so including someone being stabbed in the hand and a strangling of a domestic partner.
Such a list of charges. Your article includes a few of them here, and again, illegal possession of guns, multiple charges of assault and battery, attempted robbery with dangerous weapon, and witness intimidation. A real list of charges to make them wonder why a person like this
was out. And he had served some, prison time, but he was out at the time. And what was happening was that Sergeant Gannon, posthumously promoted to sergeant, was with a group of police trying to serve a warrant on him for a probation violation. And the Yarmouth police won't even call him by the suspect by his name. They call him 125 because they say that he's been, charged at least 125 times with charges, including some serious and violent charges.
And the delegation is asking for answers. Who do they want to hear from in all of this?
Well, they want that oversight hearing up on Beacon Hill, and they would like to have it sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. And they would like to get something done. And they say they want to look at the trial courts, witness protection, and probation departments. And State Senator Julian Sears said, they owe it to Sergeant Gannon and the Yarmouth Police Department to see really what happened, if there are any, if there are any holes in this public safety safety net, if we can learn any lessons from this. And the state's representative, Timothy Whalen, who is a retired state police sergeant himself, said that we want to know how 125 was on the streets and not locked away. And he raised, are there any systemic problems with the criminal justice system that need to be addressed in this case? And they want to take a look because this has, this was a terrible tragedy. And this was, everybody's wondering what this man was doing, on the streets at the time.
And this letter went out to the governor and the attorney general as well, so we'll be following to see what happens with this next. There's a new program available now to Cape residents with private wells, and it offers free water testing for harmful chemicals.
Yeah, this is a federally funded research effort. It started this week, and it's got a kind of a mouthful of a name. It's for a sources, transport, exposure, and effects of PFAS. PFAS are perfluorinated chemicals. They're found in firefighting foams and nonstick cookware, among other things. And this program does have an acronym. It's called STEEP. It's much less of a mouthful. But the problem with these PFAS is that they're linked to thyroid issues, problems with fetal development, liver damage, testicular and kidney cancer as well. Now, what the program wants to do is test up to 250 private wells in 5 years. So that would be about 50 a year. And this is a collaboration between the University of Rhode Island, the Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and the Silent Spring Institute.
And they're offering free water testing for some folks with private wells here.
Right. And this is free, but people have to sign up, and it probably will be people with private wells that are located closer to sources of possible exposure. Those are probably the ones that will be selected. And as we know, that the chemicals in the groundwater and soil, that the Cape has a lot of concerns mm-hmm. with this. Perfluorinated chemicals, contamination. There have been chemicals in the groundwater and soil found on and near Joint Base Cape Cod, the Barnstable Municipal Airport, and the Barnstable County Fire and Rescue Training Academy in Hyannis. And as a matter of fact, levels above the Environmental Protection Agency's health advisory threshold have triggered two temporary public health advisories since 2015 in Hyannis.
And there's even been some law actions around this.
Yeah, last week, two law firms representing Hyannis residents who believe they may have been affected by this contamination filed a class action lawsuit in U.S. District Court. They're suing five manufacturers of firefighting foams, and they're seeking damages for those who believe they may have been sickened by this exposure.
Hmm. Let's turn to a story about the rest area on Route 6, which may be receiving some fresh energy. There's talk of a public-private partnership for this spot.
Federal authorities gave Barnstable County the go-ahead to explore this private-public partnership. And this is the rest area eastbound between 6 and 7, and it gets 100,000 visitors a year.
100,000. I was surprised what a large number that was.
Yeah.
But when you think about the traffic on that road.
When you think about the traffic on that road, it slows down. People just want to get over the bridge. Once they get over the bridge, they need to have their pit stop. But this is actually leased from the Massachusetts Department of Public Transport. The Massachusetts Department of Transportation. The county leases the land. But it's been a bit of a money drain for the county because Barnstable County pays $40,000 a year to maintain that property. And so basically they've dipped into their Cape and Islands license fund, and then that's what they want to set aside for economic development activities, not, you know, cleaning restrooms.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea now is to, like, well, we'll get somebody else in there. We'll get a private enterprise in there, maybe a fast food restaurant, maybe a convenience store, and something could be in there as early as the summer of 2019.
And that business would be responsible for maintaining the rest area then.
Right, exactly. And State Senator Julian Sear says he anticipates meeting in June with DOT county officials and state reps Timothy Whalen and William Crocker. And they want to have requests for proposals out by fall or early winter.
Mm. And you'd think 100,000 people would be enough to support a business. And if there's a business there, probably going to draw even more.
That's true.
People have a reason to stop there.
That's right.
We're going to speak now with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, Tisbury voters at the town election this week voted down the proposal for a new school. We talked about this a couple of weeks back when town mm-hmm. meeting, after a lot of discussion, voted to support the construction of a new school. What can you tell us about the vote and about what it means for the proposal? What happens now?
Yeah, it is really the big question is what happens now after. And what one thing that's clear that is going to happen is that debate is going to continue about a new elementary school. Because after, you know, it's been years of debates, and as you mentioned, two nights at town meeting were really dedicated to talking about the school proposal, and it passed fairly easily at town meeting, 316-99, to build this new school with a $46 million price tag. But it was also on the town election ballot this week on Tuesday for the town election, and was a Proposition 2.5 override, so the town had to prove the funding. And it was a different story, and it was turned down by a pretty narrow margin. It lost by 21 votes, 567 against and 546 in favor. And it really does leave the fate of the school project up in the air. They have the $14 million in state funding that hangs in the balance that they had, you know, they've been working with this Massachusetts School Building Authority to come up with a plan. And after vetting several options, the plan that was presented to the town was to build a brand new school. And, you know, price has been an issue that's come up a lot. Even with the $14 million in state funding, it would leave the town with about $32 million to pay. And I think the estimate was that it would raise property taxes by about $100 per $100,000 of property for the next 20 years or so. So it was a pretty big capital project, mm-hmm. and that was certainly one of the issues that came up. But they did have this funding and the town had been working with the state authority to come up with this project. So now it's unclear, you know, that state funding hangs in the balance. And really the next step is going to be discussed next week when the school building committee will reconvene after the events of the last several weeks. They'll discuss the outcome and next steps. I would guess, you know, that options include going back to the drawing board, perhaps trying to have another vote. And certainly, you know, it's been really interesting because even after the election, our story about the outcome of the election has, I think, about 60 comments so far from people on both sides still hashing out, you know, which way is best. But the one thing that's really clear from the debate is that there is one point of consensus, which is that something needs to be done about the school. You know, it's too small. Classes have been taught in a modular building. There's not enough room for special education. So that seems to be clear that something needs to be done, but there is still this debate about what that looks like. But it's clear from the vote that, that this is going to be have to be revisited in some way, and some either a new plan or another vote will have to take place.
Just looking through the listener comments under your article on this, there is so much passion about this on both sides. It's evident.
Definitely. Yeah, and it was clear on Tuesday. You know, the people who are supporting the school did turn out, and there were a lot of signs, you know, and even students were holding signs asking for a yes vote for the school because it was a half day of school. And the Tisbury School is, you know, pretty much right across the street from the polling place. So kids were, you know, playing on the fields and holding signs. But there are also, you know, people who are passionate about saving the old school building, too, who think that it shouldn't be torn down, that there should be, you know, one comment I just saw said there should be more out-of-the-box thinking about maybe how to save the existing building, which, you know, dates back to 1929. There's also a lot of passion from some people about saving that building and others who are really passionate that there needs to be, that the best option had been, that they'd come to the best option already and that it was a new building. Yeah, so it's certainly been a really, one of the, it's been interesting to see how passionate people are on both sides. It's really been a big issue in that in Tisbury.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Bye.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the line with us is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, the League of Women's Voters has canceled the debate in Chatham. It's the first time in a long time that this has happened, and the circumstances are kind of unusual, it sounds like. Explain for us what this is about.
Sure. Yeah, they were going to have a debate on April 27th, but a couple of circumstances have prevented that. You know, usually the League of Women Voters is basically put up as very nonpartisan and very just strictly business when it comes to doing debates. Mm-hmm. They do debates, and as you know, in Cape Cod towns, they do them in most of the Cape Cod towns. They moderate and provide timekeepers and things like that. One of the candidates in the Chatham selectman's race, Jamie Bassett, kind of questioned the nonpartisan status of the league when they sent out requests for the candidates to confirm a date. And he never really got back to them about that. And one of the other candidates, Seth Taylor, who is a former selectman, is running for one of the 3-year seats that's on the ballot this year. He could not make the first date, and the league had 2 alternate dates, which he was not able to commit to either. So between those two, the league decided at some point last week that, you know, they couldn't wait any longer, and they had to cancel the debate. This is too bad, like you said, Steve. It's been at least 20 years since that the League of Women Voters have been, you know, sponsoring debates in Chatham, and this is the first time in anybody's memory that they've canceled one. And now the Chatham voters will have an opportunity to hear the candidates this coming Wednesday at a forum sponsored by the Alliance for Preservation and Conservation, which is a group of 15 local nonprofits, and they're going to hold that debate at 3:00 on Wednesday at the Eldridge Library. The difference is that this debate won't be televised on cable, and it won't be available for viewing afterwards, which is what all the league debates were, and one of the issues involved in not being able to agree on a date was that there were only certain dates open for the room where they could tape those meetings. So, you know, a number of complications ensued in this, and unfortunately, it's the Chatham voters who are going to come out on the short end here.
It's really a service to the voters that's being taken away here if they can't see their candidates in debate.
Yeah, it really is. And three of the candidates, there's five candidates running for three seats on the Board of Selectmen this year in Chatham. Three of them, incumbents Corey Metters and Dean DeCastro and Planning Board Chairman Peter Kukulis, they all had agreed to the League of Women Voters date. So it's unfortunate that the other two candidates just could not reach any kind of agreement or consensus there. And but apparently all five of them are going to be at the debate this coming Wednesday. So there'll be that opportunity. But unfortunately, it's less than voters would usually have to make their decision about a candidate for the May 14th annual election here.
And what did the League of Women Voters have to say about questions about their partisanship or nonpartisanship?
Well, they pointed to their regulations, their rules and regulations, which have strict rules about being nonpartisan for both members of the board and for debates like this. I talked to Florence Selden, who's a former president of the league and a Chatham resident, and she does she's going to be doing moderating a whole bunch of discussions, debates at candidates' nights around the Cape this next coming few weeks. And she was adamant that they've always been nonpartisan. They're strict about that in their rules. Members have rules about what they can and can't do, as far as if they run for office. There's a certain steps that they have to take. They can't take positions that are public. It's a whole roster of regulations that they have about maintaining that nonpartisanship. And there were both Florence Selden and other League of Women Voters officials that I talked to were very adamant that they really stick to that. And they don't know where these concerns about them being nonpartisan are coming from. And I tried to reach out to Jamie Bassett. Who was the one who objected to that. And he never got back to me about specifics about what concerns he had. And he said he had raised those concerns 2 years ago when he was running a campaign for Amanda Love. And I had heard some things from League of Women Voters about what happened at that time. But there was really no further explanation from him about why he felt that way.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times. Towns of Dennis and Yarmouth are talking about the need for a new middle school. They've done some planning for this, but there's the sticky question of how to pay for it and how the costs are divided between the towns. And this is not a new issue here.
No, there's always debate between Dennis and Yarmouth about who's going to pay for what. They have a regional school agreement that is based on enrollment, and Dennis is a much smaller town with that's losing students, and Yarmouth is the bigger town that's gaining students. So Yarmouth always has the lion's share of the cost. And this this debate is continuing about the new school. It'll be grades 4 through 7, and it looks like we'll be on Station Avenue in South Yarmouth next to the Station Avenue Elementary School. Now, there's a lot of enthusiasm. There's a lot of support for this school that would replace really, you know, aging middle schools, the Mattakese Middle School in West Yarmouth and the Nathaniel H. Wixon Innovation School in South Dennis. But Yarmouth Selectmen want to make sure that Dennis pays what they consider its fair share of the school. The total cost is $109 million, but there's up to $61 million eligible in reimbursement from the Massachusetts School Building Authority. At this point, Yarmouth taxpayers have already footed the whole $750,000 bill for a study that resulted in the recommendation for this joint middle school.
And the cost for either of these towns would be a lot more if they were to do it alone. So there's a real financial incentive to be working together for this.
Absolutely. But Yarmouth Selectman Norman Holcomb has argued that the cost of the common areas in the school should be split equally between the towns. I'm not sure how they would work that out, but he wants the common area split equally between the towns. He said it's not really fair to use these enrollment figures as the basis for the cost sharing, because he said it doesn't count local students who go to charter schools or other Cape public schools through school choice. And he says the DY district is still responsible for those students, financially responsible for those students. And he said if you factor that in, that would increase the dentist operating assessment.
I thought it was interesting, too. They were looking at what happens if you delay this decision. And for every each month that it's delayed, there's a substantial uptick in the price tag.
Right. And they need the DY district needs to submit the preferred plan by May 9th to be eligible for approval at the June 27th School Building Authority the School Building Authority Board of Directors meeting. Yeah, delays are added cost. What was it, like a million?
It's $500,000. It raises, the price goes up, $500,000 each month it's delayed, according to the report that they filed, and this is called market escalation. So they really are trying to make decisions quickly with an eye towards that price tag.
Right, they're trying to come to some kind of agreement before they have an even higher cost. And right now, according to current enrollment, Dennis would pay $23 million for construction, and Yarmouth would pay $47 million.
We're going to speak with Josh Balling now at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, scallop season has come to an end. What was the outcome?
The outcome was positive. Despite some pretty nasty weather over a good chunk of the winter, the nor'easters that everybody experienced, and some pretty cold temperatures on a number of days that kept the boats at the dock, more scallops harvested this year than in the last couple of years. They estimate that about 13,000 bushels of scallops will be harvested when the final numbers come in, and that's more than double, almost triple, the 5,000 bushels that came in last year. So scallopers and marine scientists will tell you they're not exactly sure why. There's all kinds of factors that go into that. Some of the long-time scallopers out here say it's just cyclical. These things happen, but 20, 30 years ago, there was almost 100,000 bushels being harvested out of Nantucket waters, and now it's down in the a good year is 20,000. So something's going on out there. But it was a good year, the scalloper said, and they even got about a 2.5-week extension on the season. Usually ends the last day of March, but because of that bad weather, because of the cold temperatures, and because there was still an abundance of mature scallops out there, the State Division of Marine Fisheries allowed the extra 2-week extension, and some scallopers say that probably means for the fishery maybe six or 800 bushels are still left, but about $25,000 to $30,000 more to the fishermen who are still fishing by the end of the season.
There's some continuing debate over bluff protection project on the island's east end. Tell us about this.
This is a project that is intended to curb erosion in Sconset on the edge of the Baxter Road Bluff, the Sankaty Bluff, where Sankaty Head Lighthouse is, and there's a road that goes out toward that lighthouse with a number of summer homes on it primarily. There have been efforts underway for years to protect the bluff, protect the homes at the top of the bluff and the base of the bluff from erosion. A number of homes have had to have been moved or demolished because of that erosion. And a group called the Sconset Beach Preservation Fund has had permission to protect about 1,000 feet of the base of the bluff with geotextile tubes. And the selectmen and the SBPF agreed that if that worked, if it was determined to have worked after 3 years, they could go ahead with a plan to seek to armor or protect about 4,000 more feet. But town council told the select board this week that that's not a binding agreement. It's not legally binding in his opinion, and causing some consternation among the SBPF and some members of the Board of Selectmen who say even if it's not legally binding, they acted in good faith and they should still be allowed to move forward. But it's been a controversial issue. There's a number of opponents to the project. They feel that perhaps town funding shouldn't be used to pay for some of this stuff. Some of it is on town land. The town says it's not their funding. It is private funding that is going into it. But if the road were to go, the county would be on the hook for providing access. A group called the Coastal Conservancy has been opposed to it for environmental reasons. They're concerned about the harbor bottom, what the sand is going to be doing to that. Sorry, not the harbor bottom, but the ocean floor, as well as the impact of erosion on either end of where the protection is happening, what's going to happen to land there. So an ongoing issue that is not going to be resolved anytime soon.
And Josh, we have to mention that Daffodil Festival weekend is ahead of us. It's really the kickoff to the season on the island.
It is. Visitors started arriving earlier this week. The boats were full yesterday. They're going to be full today, and tomorrow really kicks off our annual Daffodil Festival. More than 40 years it's been going on. The island is blanketed in yellow. There's a classic car parade, a flower show, two-day flower show. Daffodil is one of the few flowers that deer out here on Nantucket don't like, so that's why they're so prolific everywhere. But really, yeah, the kickoff to the spring, if not the summer season. I expect about 10,000 or more visitors to be here over the weekend. The merchants are happy. As long as the weather cooperates, everybody has a good time.
Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times is with me in the studio. Cindy, town meeting in Sandwich is going to be asked to approve $2 million to repair its iconic boardwalk. But there's also a volunteer effort being discussed in this.
Yeah, local builder Shane Hochter has about 50 volunteers, he said, will donate time and expertise to fix the boardwalk. And it was just battered by the string of nor'easters, and a big section of it is still closed. And he said he feels really strongly it should be open for summer. It's a big, it's a big draw for people who live in town. It's just a beautiful spa, but it's also a draw for tourists. And as a matter of fact, National Geographic lists it as one of the top 10 boardwalks in the country.
And of course, it's historic. It goes back to the 1800s, late 1800s.
Yeah, it was first built in 1875 by Gustavus Howland, and it's been rebuilt a number of times, however, with the support of local craftsmen. Its location means that it does get hit by these storms. And after Hurricane Bob destroyed it in 1991, a local fundraising effort to rebuild it had it open just by the next year, by 1992. And people were able to, contribute money, have boards dedicated in their name. And I don't know if that's going to be considered to be part of this project, but that was one of the fun things about walking the boardwalk, was looking for people that you know, or looking, for what inscriptions were on there. And some repairs have already been made. The town has made some short-term repairs to stairs on up by the boardwalk, and inmates in the Barnstable County Correctional Facility have fixed about 200 feet of the walkway that's connected to the town Neck Beach parking lot.
And if volunteers are used, I guess there's some question about the oversight and how
liability,
that works.
Liability. Sandwich Selectman David Sampson says that he's the town has some concerns about that, obviously. But the Sandwich Selectman David Sampson said that that Shane Hochter has recruited skilled construction crews, and he has countless others willing to assist. So they would have to get some kind of, permits that would cover the people and the workers. And right now, the town is also getting quotes from contractors to get a sense of what the work would cost, just the overall scope of the entire project.
And the price for this is also, it's going to town meeting, it sounds like, and it's sort of wrapped in with other repairs as well.
Yeah, it's going to be tied to other road and infrastructure improvements and a debt exclusion. So
we are going to speak with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Steve.
Casey, in Provincetown, the select board has found itself on the wrong side of a deadline when it comes to the upcoming town election. Tell us what happened here.
All right. Well, this is very strange. A charter revision committee has been working on revising the town's charter, which is sort of like the constitution for each municipal government. And they've been working for a long time. The selectmen had it on the agenda for months. They were really working on it, really focused on it. But somehow they missed the fact that by law they were supposed to send it out to all registered voters 2 weeks before the May 1st election. And they did not realize that until Tuesday, leaving them a week. So they held an emergency meeting at 4 p.m. on Tuesday, and it was very strange. Town Council told them, and I just have to read this quote because it's just so unusual. This is Town Council John Giorgio said, "I have to tell you, you have not complied with the law, and it is the requirement of the Board of Selectmen. Obviously, you cannot comply with a two-week requirement. Strict compliance is not an option at this point." So what he advised them to do, and what the selectmen are doing, is make copies of it, print out as many copies as possible, get them in the mail, post them everywhere, post them online, post them on their website, and just get it out there, like blanket the town with them as quickly as possible. So that's what they've done. And then I don't think anyone really knows what's going to happen next. I mean, it's been the Charter Commission has been very controversial, and the selectmen had a lot of criticism. So who knows? Maybe it won't even pass. But either way, it's there's a lot up in the air. It's quite unusual.
Well, one would think that if it passed, it would be open to question by people who are opposed, that the process was flawed.
Exactly. And if it fails, the members of the Charter Commission could also contest it, saying
that's
that
right.
The selectmen didn't do their duty. Yeah.
Okay.
So very interesting.
I want to ask you about another story as well. In Wellfleet, town meeting was asked to address zoning around retail sales of marijuana. It was following on the planning board's recommendation, but this didn't go the way the planning board wanted it to, apparently. What happened here?
No, the planning board wanted to get the retail marijuana shops to be in the same place where the town has already approved medical marijuana shops, which is basically portions of Route 6 in South Wellfleet. And the people who live in South Wellfleet were really not very happy with that idea. Suddenly an application came in. The selectmen signed an agreement, not an agreement, but a non-opposition agreement, I guess, with the one company on Old Wharf Road. And anyway, the South Wellfleetians have been really up in arms about it. And at town meeting, they came out and they said, why should this be segregated to one section of town? And they won. They won their argument. So it looks like now, according to the planning board, there really isn't an opportunity to zone it at this point before the regulations, before retail marijuana is on the ground. So it's interesting because Valerio Romano, who represents a lot of the marijuana companies coming in, actually spoke at town meeting saying, we like this bylaw. All that postponement does is keep the Zoning Board of Appeals from having oversight, which may not be what you want as voters, but voters voted it down anyway. I think a lot of the opposition was also related to the fact that the craft marijuana growers, local mm-hmm. growers, did not want a moratorium because they felt they'd miss a growing season, and there was a lot of support for that.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And joining us on the phone right now is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Cindy, and good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
George, in Oak Bluffs, the Select Board has voted to close scenic East Chop Drive to vehicle traffic. Tell us about this.
Yeah, well, it's hard to imagine on this beautiful spring morning, but we had a few storms back in March. Do you remember those, Steve?
Yeah.
Those four nor'easters. East Chop Drive was already in a fragile state, and those just really decimated it even more. That road, East Chop Drive, was already closed on the lane closest to the bluff, so it was only one-way traffic to begin with. But now the town's engineer is saying that, you know, no one should be driving on that road. And so the selectmen voted to close it down. An interesting part of the debate, though, was the engineer, in an abundance of caution, urged the selectmen to also close it to pedestrian traffic and bicycle traffic. But the selectmen weren't having any of that. They didn't believe that someone walking on this road or someone riding a bicycle on this road was going to add to the erosion issue. So they agreed to close it to cars and trucks, but not close it to bicycles and pedestrians as well. Interesting quote, if you would, from mm-hmm. one of the selectmen, hearkening back to Jaws, who said, I don't want to get into a situation where we have a scene from Jaws where we let everybody swim when we knew there was a shark. So, so that was an interesting part of the meeting as well.
So Jaws as your reference point of public safety, yes. George, the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. heard a case this week that involved the Martha's Vineyard man. Tell us what this is about.
Yeah, that's right. And we were fortunate to have someone there, Jack Fruchtman, who does a lot of op-ed pieces for us. He's a constitutional lawyer in Maryland, but he also is a seasonal resident on Martha's Vineyard. And he agreed to go, and I was able to get him press access to the Supreme Court. Pretty interesting for a small newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sat in on the oral arguments. And this is a case, you know, that could have national implications, the outcome. It has to do with a complicated part of the law, which is called the stop rule. I didn't really know this prior to this case, that if someone does come to the country on a visa and they overstay it, and they're able to stay in the country for 10 years, that they're allowed to remain in the country after that. But Pereira, who is the focus of this case, Wesley Pereira, he got arrested during that 10-year period, and he was given a notice to appear for a deportation hearing. The problem is there wasn't any date on it. And then one was mailed to him by Homeland Security, but it was mailed to his street address, and he had a post office box. And anybody on the island here knows that many people do have post office boxes, and they don't get delivery at their homes. So he never got that notice. The argument in this case is that because he never got notice to the hearing, his time in the country never stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And so it will be decided by the Supreme Court. They're expected to issue their decision before their session ends in June. So we'll stay tuned for the outcome. It's a complicated story. I encourage people to take a look at it to get all the ins and outs. Jack is an expert in constitutional law, and he's done a nice job putting the whole case together.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good weekend.
Cindy McCormick is with me from the Cape Cod Times. And Cindy, Harwich Town Meeting is approaching, and one of the more contested topics is likely to be support for a pet crematory.
Now, Harwich has a new pet cemetery, but whether it will also have the pet crematory will be up to the town meeting May 7th. Both the Board of Selectmen and the Finance Committee have unanimously recommended this, putting an article on the warrant that would call for constructing a 1,500-square-foot pet crematory and a cemetery commission office at the cemetery on Queen Anne Road, and that would be a cost of about $580,000. But Monday night, some residents at a Board of Selectmen's meeting asked the selectmen to rescind this and just take it right off the and take it off the warrant. They asked, why should the town put money in an enterprise that's already handled by private businesses?
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Birch said, I have no idea why we're spending money on this, and I will vote against it.
And some questions here about the projections for revenue for this pet crematory.
The cemetery administrator, Robin Kelly, says that she's predicting that they'll see a profit within 4 years of a 10-year loan. She said Duxbury and Plymouth have already built pet crematories, and they're seeing significant revenue. So she sees this as a possible moneymaker for the town. And this crematory would also serve, you know, pet owners not just from Harwich but from surrounding areas. And it would also be a fast turnaround. People won't have to wait weeks for their, you know, to get their pet's ashes back. It could possibly be on the same day. And Kelly is saying that if, you know, if they don't do it, another town or private business will do it here, you know, in the Cape area. And they'll be getting that business instead of the town of Harwich.
The select board did not withdraw this from the town meeting article. It's going to town meeting to be debated.
Yeah, it will be on the floor of town meeting. It'll be a hot topic.
Jim Kinsella is with us from the Enterprise Newspapers. Hiya, Jim.
Good morning, Steve.
Jim, tensions are on the rise again between the town of Mashpee and the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, and this is around a proposed federal legislation connected to the tribe's land in trust. Explain this for us.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. What's going on here is the tribe has run into some legal trouble up in Taunton. They wanted to build a $1.5 billion casino up there. And anyway, some neighbors have objected to that. And they kind of went right at the matter of whether the federal government, in fact, could recognize the tribe and give them land and trust. So that's continuing to move through the courts. Meanwhile, a short time ago, Congressman William Keating in Bourne, the local congressman, he put forward some legislation, got it co-sponsored, and it's also similar legislation now moving through the Senate to basically recognized through congressional action the land and trust situation. However, first of all, they apparently never told the town of Mashpee about this or the Board of Selectmen about this. So the Selectmen's chairman, Tom O'Hara, has been quoted as saying the first time he learned of it was reading about it in the newspaper. Mm. So that didn't get things off to a good foot. And as you had mentioned, there have been some longstanding tensions there between the town and the tribe. Now there's further concern or worry on the part of the selectmen that this legislation, in fact, conceivably could open the door to the tribe once again mounting a land claim suit in the town of Mashpee. And that would be a very difficult and very divisive sort of thing. It initially occurred back in the 1970s when the tribe came forward and brought federal action to acquire land in the town of Mashpee, citing ancestral homeland. They lost that case, but it essentially shut down development in the town for some time and kind of is a period that's the source of these continuing tensions. So, again, the selectmen concerned that this legislation, if it doesn't specifically reference an agreement that was made in 2008 between the tribe and the town to basically the tribe would forswear any future land suit legislation, or excuse me, land suit legal action in Mashpee, that could be trouble.
And what does the tribe say about this from their point
well,
of view?
The tribe says, they Cedric Cromwell, the chairman, he issued a statement earlier this week, and he said, we at the tribe, yes, the agreement remains in force. Basically, you don't have anything to worry about. The town's not so sure, so that's kind of where things stand right now.
And Keating is overseeing this legislation as it goes forward. Is it fully crafted? Does it have room for this kind of thing to be tweaked?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting point you raise, Steve, because the town says they, in fact, support the legislation. They want the tribe to have land and trust. But they just want an amendment added to the legislation, basically recognizing this 2008 agreement to forswear any future land suits, you know, in the town of Mashpee seeking land. So things are kind of up in the air right now, but again, it has sort of reignited some tension in the town.
Jim Kinsella from the Enterprise Newspapers. Jim, thanks for joining us with that.
You're welcome, Steve. Take care.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times is with me in the studio. Cindy, in Falmouth, folks got a look at early designs for the long-anticipated new senior center.
This was during a meeting Tuesday at the current senior center on Dillingham Avenue. That's a 41-year-old senior center, and it's going to be replaced by a new one built on Main Street between the Gus Canty Community Center and the police station. It sounds pretty nice. It'll be two stories with 7,500 square feet on each floor. There's going to be a cafe and a library toward the back of the first floor where there's more sun. There'll be a patio out there. The cafe will have a fireplace, bookcases, and television. There'll be a big kitchen. But residents also had additional ideas, and they offered, and for some of them, they weren't included in the plans, and they said, we're going to get fundraisers out there to, you know, incorporate a few more things that we want. Judy Fenwick wants solar panels, and she suggested that the Friends of Seniors help fundraise for them.
Because they hadn't been incorporated into the design.
Right. They're not incorporated in. And dance instructor Ellen Brodsky would like to see a wooden floor in the all-purpose room instead of vinyl. And she had a petition with 75 signatures. And she also offered to help fundraise to make this wooden floor a possibility. And someone else suggested a generator, which is not currently in the budget.
You would think a generator might be a good idea.
Yeah, after this winter.
Yeah. And how about parking for this facility?
Well, there'll be 250 parking spaces. There'll be more than the senior center currently has. And the Boston architect Joel Bargman also presented a couple sketches for the exterior. There's one sketch show two gables that would resemble the Gus Canty Center next door, which will be actually connected via an indoor ramp. There's also a plan that shows, you know, the traditional Cape Cod gray siding, which was popular. Mm-hmm. Some design showing a more contemporary building drew negative responses from the attendees. And this is Cape Cod. We like our Cape Cod style.
I want to talk about a story. The Steamship Authority held its monthly board meeting this week in Vineyard Haven. It was an opportunity for plenty of folks to sound off on the recent run of service problems with the ferry line and on other issues, too.
Oh, people did spout off. There was a lot of fury and frustration expressed with this string of events that at one point had an unprecedented thing happen. There are three ferries out of service all at one time. And so this was the monthly board meeting Monday, and one resident, Catherine Cavanaugh of Vineyard Haven, said, "You've cost us medical appointments, you've cost us hotel bills, you've cost us paying for parking when it's not our fault. We can't go." And that went into, you know, complaints about customer service, communications, design, the durability of the vessels, and also, you know, who's in charge here? Why is all this happening? People said that, you know, hundreds of people were stranded in Woods Hole after on March 3rd, and they didn't get any communication from the Steamship Authority about, you know, hey, find a hotel, you know, you're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of frustration expressed. And, you know, at one point, the Steamship Authority chartered a high-speed vessel from C Street but it really strained to fill the gaps in the schedule. It wasn't adequate.
And the Steamship Authority said what then?
Well, the general manager, Robert Davis, said that, you know, the Steamship Authority takes pride in dependable service, and they're really embarrassed by these recent failures. And he said they're going to be looking to, they'll be examining different areas like repair schedules, information technology systems to see if patterns are emerging. Board member Mark Hanover said he wants an independent review of the Steamship Authority. He wants it to start before the summer season commences. He said these 3 weeks were pure hell. People miss vacations, people miss doctor's appointments, and it's just unacceptable. I mean, they're on an island. they need transportation. This was an unprecedented situation, but people want to make sure it never happens again.
Mm-hmm. Cindy, a story this week about a police officer who was a witness in the case of a Kituit man accused of killing his wife. The officer was in court to testify well ahead of the trial. Explain to us why this is happening.
Barnesville Police Sergeant Jason Labor will be deployed overseas with the U.S. Navy next month. And so he was able to testify 6 weeks early, and his testimony was videotaped in Barnesville Superior Court on Monday. And he was a key witness because Labor testified that Christopher Frantantonio told him and other officers that he had killed his wife. He met at the door and told him that he killed his wife, Mary Frantantonio, when they responded to 89 Troutbrook Road, Kituit. That was around 2 a.m. February 28th. Very tragic situation where Mary Frantantonio's body was found upstairs in a bedroom, and there were two children, and the couple's two children were in the home. There was a six-year-old daughter and a two-year-old son.
So the lawyers were all there. They had this officer testifying in advance of the trial, and in the end, there were also people from Mary Frantantonio's brother was there and really took issue with what he was hearing.
He was upset with what Christopher Frantantonio's attorney, Colleen Duarte, said. She said that, you know, she talked about her client discovering texts on his wife's phone between her and another man. And Christopher Frantantonio actually told police that he read a text message from his wife's phone that upset him. He went outside to have a cigarette, and then he said he went upstairs and stabbed her. But Mary Frantantonio's brother, Ian McClatchy, is saying, you know, his sister was a victim of domestic violence. The defense is painting her in this unfair light. And he said she'd suffered abuse, and she was really trying hard to get out of this relationship at the time of the murder. So, and he said, you know, her husband attacked her while she was sleeping in front of her two children. So.
Cindy, you had a story this week. I want to end with something a little more upbeat on that. This was about a number of people pulling together to help a man who's in hospice to be able to get to see his son's wedding.
A couple from Brockton, Jacqueline Hilton and Matthew Callis, had planned the perfect June wedding in Maine for months, but they took a detour to the town clerk's office for a marriage license this week after Matthew's father, Peter Callis, suffered a setback. He has pancreatic cancer, and he was admitted to the Mary McCarthy Center in Sandwich. That's an hospice inpatient center in Sandwich, and he was admitted last Thursday. Friday, they talked to the hospice chaplain, Vera O'Brien, about their plans, and by Tuesday, they had the marriage license in hand. Jackie had run out and got a white dress. Stop and Shop had donated a beautiful bouquet of yellow and white flowers. The hospice, which is run by Hope Health, actually the officials there went out and they used this compassion fund to buy this beautiful fluffy white wedding cake from Best Bakery and Sandwich. They pulled it together. It was a small group, very emotional. tears, and a niece put it on Facebook for about 30 viewers for relatives who couldn't be there. And Peter Kallos was just so proud of his son Matthew, and he said I told him that marrying Jackie was the smartest thing he ever did.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And thanks to our contributors. We heard from Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke with Josh Balling, the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Jim Kinsella from the Enterprise Papers. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.